Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Miller Center of Public Affairs, to our forum program. As you may have noticed, I am not George Gillum. My dear colleague has taken a well-deserved vacation, and he sends his best to all of you. We appreciate you being here today. I am, however, Maurice Jones, the Director of Development for the Miller Center Foundation, and it's my honor to host this morning's forum. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to take a moment to thank all of you for your support of the Miller Center. These are exciting times for the center. Our established programs are flourishing, while our new initiatives like the National Discussion and Debate Series promise to keep the Miller Center a national meeting place for journalists, policymakers, the public, and many others for years to come. As we close out our fiscal year, I'd like to thank those of you who have already given to the Miller Center Foundation. Your support is greatly appreciated. I ask for others who have not given just yet to please consider the Miller Center in your philanthropic planning. I'm a little biased here, but I think it's a worthy investment, so thank you. Now on to the program. Our speaker today, Bruce Riedel, is a leading expert in the field of counterterrorism in the Middle East. He has had a long career in the national intelligence arena, serving as the Director for Gulf and South Asia Affairs in the National Security Council from 1991 to 1993, Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Near East and South Asian Affairs from 1997 to 2001, and Special Advisor to NATO from 2003 to 2006. He is now a Senior Fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and he's also celebrating today the 30th anniversary of his entrance into the CIA. Please join me in welcoming Bruce Riedel.
Thank you for that very kind introduction, and thank all of you for coming out today. I recently published an article entitled Al-Qaeda Strikes Back, which is in the current edition of Foreign Affairs. Don't worry, I'm not going to bore you by reading to you what I wrote in that article. But what I do want to do today is continue to develop some of the themes that I laid out in that article about the status of the Al-Qaeda organization today and the threat that it poses to our country. Just over 2,000 days ago, a gang of 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists attacked America and committed the largest act of mass murder in our country's history. Now, 5.5 years after that atrocity, the men who organized that attack, who planned it, who funded it, and who trained the terrorist which conducted it are alive and well. Even worse, they are still planning terror and violence. I believe the Al-Qaeda organization today is actually more dangerous than it was on September 11th, despite some very significant setbacks that it has suffered in the last 5.5 years. Sir Richard Dearlove, former chief of MI6, the British Secret Intelligence Service, now head of Pembroke College in Cambridge, and one of the world's foremost practitioners of counterterrorism and counterintelligence, noted recently, quote, "We need to think carefully about where we go now in confronting the consequences of September 11th. Our strategy, our strategic position is weak regarding Al-Qaeda. At the moment, it is all too easy for Al-Qaeda to recruit new foot soldiers. Our policy and strategy fundamentally needs to change." Contrast that with the tone of the enemy. Last month, Al-Qaeda's chief spokesman, Ayman al-Zawahiri, issued another one of his long diatribes. Here is what he said. "I give the good news to the Muslim Ummah, and not just it, but all the world's oppressed, the victims of Western Crusader repression, that's us, that the empire of evil is about to come to an end, and that a new dawn is about to arise, God permitting, over a mankind liberated from the Caesars of the White House, Europe, and the Zionists. This is altogether typical of al-Qaeda's rhetoric today. They proclaim not just their survival from the counterattack launched after September 11th, but their victory. They believe and argue that thanks to their leadership, the Muslim world, or Ummah, is today for the first time in more than 90 years successfully resisting the attack of the Crusaders and the Zionists. Not since the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1919, they argue, has the Muslim world been as successful as it is today in resisting Western and American domination. The al-Qaeda leadership proclaims the victory of their jihad and of the knights, as they call them, who lead it in their propaganda almost every day now. A central key to the success of al-Qaeda's strategy since September 11th has been the creation of al-Qaeda affiliates, or what I call franchises, in different parts of the region of the Middle East and South Asia, each of which operates largely independently of the central core, but takes allegiance to the al-Qaeda emir, Osama bin Laden, and gets its overall principles and ideology from the al-Qaeda core. I want to spend some time today discussing the development of these local franchises and explaining why it is so important. Al-Qaeda was established in 1998 as an alliance of several jihadist groups in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. They call themselves the World Islamic Front, and they proclaim their purpose to, quote, kill Americans and their allies in order to liberate the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and the Holy Mosque in Mecca from the grip of their armies. Note the order: Al-Aqsa first, Mecca second. That tells you something about their overall objectives. No average Muslim would put that order, Jerusalem before Mecca. It is an extraordinary statement of intent, and I'll come back to that. In less than a decade since 1998, bin Laden and his movement have established a truly global presence. Since September 2001, al-Qaeda or its affiliates, franchises, and sympathizers have carried out terrorist attacks in Algiers, in Casablanca, Madrid, London, Istanbul, Riyadh, Jeddah, Karachi, Sharm el-Sheikh, Taba, Mombasa, Kuwait, Mumbai, New Delhi, Bali, and other cities. And that doesn't count the carnage that they carry out every day in Afghanistan and Iraq. The breadth and audacity of attacks is a mark of the movement's success in building its local allies from Morocco to Indonesia, and especially in the Muslim diaspora in Western Europe. Critical to this success was al-Qaeda's survival in late 2001 after the American counterattack against its host in Afghanistan, the Taliban. 5 years after the fall of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, the Taliban movement, with the assistance of al-Qaeda, has made a significant comeback in Afghanistan. Those who placed the Taliban in the dustbin of history, like former Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, have been proven premature. Today, the Taliban and al-Qaeda are the prime movers in a growing insurgency in South and East Afghanistan. Attacks on NATO forces there are a daily phenomenon. NATO now finds itself in its first ever ground war. British Army commanders who fight in Afghanistan say the fight is the toughest the British Army has faced since Korea in 1953. Suicide attacks, for example, have increased dramatically. In 2002, there were two suicide attacks in Afghanistan. Today, there's a suicide attack every 72 hours. And improvised explosive devices and the technology with them imported from Iraq have become a common theme in Afghanistan. All of this, unfortunately, has developed remarkably close to the script that Taliban leader Mullah Omar, the self-proclaimed commander of the faithful, outlined in late 2001 and early 2002 when the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were on the ropes and near destruction. He lamented the catastrophe of the Emirates' fall, but he said his organization would survive and return to challenge the coalition. Here is what he said as early as 26 September 2001. Quote, "I am considering two promises. One is the promise of God, the other of Bush. The promise of God is that my land is vast. If you start a journey on God's path, you can reside anywhere and will be protected. The promise of Bush is that there is no place on earth where you can hide that I cannot find you. We will see which promise is fulfilled. Afghans have seen which promise has been fulfilled and are coming back to the Taliban, unfortunately. There are at least three key reasons for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda resurgence in Afghanistan. First, they were never fully defeated in 2001. After a few defeats on the battlefield, the Taliban did what most guerrilla organizations do when facing a superior firepower. They dispersed and went into the villages. They moved to remote areas of Pashtun Afghanistan, like Mullah Omar's home province, bid their time, and waited for the West to lose its interest. They adjusted their tactics, and they looked to their comrades in Iraq for tactical advice. Al-Qaeda played a critical role in bringing tactical innovation from Iraq back to Afghanistan. Second, the coalition, and above all, the United States, took its eyes off the Afghan ball when the invasion of Iraq began. Afghanistan went on the back burner and was given little reconstruction assistance and far too few troops. United States reconstruction assistance to Afghanistan, a country that had been devastated by a quarter century of war and had begun that quarter century among the poorest in the world, received less than $1 billion in economic aid in 2002, 2003, and 2004. Compared to other reconstruction activities like Bosnia, Kosovo, or Haiti, Afghanistan was done on the cheap, and we've got the results of doing it that way. Third, the Taliban benefited from a safe haven and assistance in Pakistan. The Taliban, of course, had extensive and long-standing connections with the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the Inner Services Intelligence Directorate. These were temporarily broken by General Musharraf after September 11th, but the alliance between the Taliban and other Kashmiri and Pakistani terrorist groups continued. These ties had developed over the course of the 1990s and were dramatically illustrated in December 1999 during the hijacking of an Indian air flight from Kathmandu to Kandahar, where Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the Kashmiris, and ISI all had the dress rehearsal for September 11th. The Afghan government today goes further than I have and accuses Pakistan and the ISI of outright support for the Taliban, and sometimes even for Al-Qaeda. General Musharraf, of course, denies this, and he correctly points to the fact that Pakistan has been the locale where more senior Al-Qaeda operatives have been arrested than anywhere else in the world. But doesn't that tell you everything? Why are they there? The truth on this issue is particularly difficult to ascertain, and I look forward to discussing it some more in questions and answers. But Pakistan is the epicenter of the world struggle against Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has also used Pakistan extensively as a fertile recruiting ground to penetrate the large Pakistani and Bangladeshi expatriate population in the United Kingdom for operational purposes against the UK and the United States. The July 7, 2005 attack on the London Underground was a dramatic demonstration of this avenue of approach into Europe. The British intelligence services have been remarkably successful in foiling many of these plots, including, most importantly, the August 2006 plot known as Operation Overt, which planned to blow up simultaneously over the mid-Atlantic 10 jumbo jets en route to the United States. That plot had successfully developed the explosives, and every American who goes to an airport knows that today, because you're not allowed to bring on liquids. That plot had the 20 martyrs ready to go. And according to President Bush, in his recent speech at the Coast Guard, it was within 2 to 3 weeks of taking place. The Chief of Scotland Yard noted recently, "The fact is there are in the UK many young men who are vulnerable to being drawn into the extremism and violence in the Pakistani community. And in case after case, the hand of the core of Al-Qaeda can clearly be seen. Arrested leaders or key players are quickly replaced, and disrupted networks reform quickly." As long as NATO keeps forces in Afghanistan, the Taliban will not march back into victory in Kabul. But that's not their objective at this point. Their objective today is to survive and to grow their insurgency. Their role model is the defeat of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and they are confident that they are on the road to great victory. With a secure base of operations reestablished in South Asia, in the Badlands along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, 1,500 miles of the most desolate and remote territory in the world, Al-Qaeda opened a series of offensives after 2002. The first offensive took place in Osama bin Laden's homeland, Saudi Arabia, which witnessed between 2003 and 2006 the longest and most sustained political violence and unrest in the kingdom's modern history. Scores of targets were attacked, including high-profile targets like the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, the compounds of Western firms, the headquarters of the Saudi Ministry of Information, the headquarters of the Saudi Ministry of Interior, and the Abqaiq oil processing facility in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, which is responsible for processing 60% of Saudi Arabia's oil product. Al-Qaeda had in mind even more devastating plots. We know from the testimony of the captured 911 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that he had a plot underway to recruit disaffected pilots in the Royal Saudi Air Force, persuade them to hijack their own fighter aircraft, and use them to bomb Israeli cities with the purpose of starting a new Arab-Israeli war. Thank God it never got off the ground. And thank God that after a series of violent gunfights throughout the kingdom, the Saudi authorities appear to have gotten, at least for the moment, the upper hand over Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia. But it is clear that this franchise is far from dead. Only this spring, the Saudis announced the arrest of almost 200 more Al-Qaeda operatives in the kingdom. But of course, Al-Qaeda's most successful franchise has been in Iraq. Founded by the late Abu Musaib al-Zarqawi, Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia has been a spectacular success from its standpoint. Although Al-Qaeda in Iraq is only a small minority of the Sunni insurgency and has actually disaffected sizable parts of the Sunni insurgency, it has been successful in its overall goal of driving Iraqi society into civil war and creating a quagmire to bog down American, British, and coalition forces. We know now from the memoirs of many people involved in the occupation of Iraq, Mr. Bremer, Mr. Tennant, and others, that the United States had no plan for the occupation of Iraq. Al-Qaeda had a plan, a brutal, evil, but effective plan. Step one, bomb the rest of the world out of Iraq, the UN, the Jordanians, the Turks, everyone who could help America. Step two, relentlessly attack the fault line of Iraqi political society, the Sunni-Shia divide between Arabs, until you created a civil war. But Zarqawi did more than that. He developed a support network throughout Europe and the Muslim world for his war in Iraq, a network which provided new martyrs, new money, and new cannon fodder. According to the National Counterterrorism Center, Zarqawi's network extends today across 40 countries, including virtually every country in the Arab world and in Western Europe. That network and al-Qaeda in Iraq are now so successful, they are making more money than they can spend on their own operations, both from ransoms and from money donated by rich donors in the Gulf. Al-Qaeda today is so flush with money in Iraq, it sends money home to the al-Qaeda core in Pakistan. Since the death of its founder, Zarqawi, the al-Qaeda franchise in Iraq has gone another step. It has announced the creation of an independent Sunni Islamist state in the western side of Iraq, in effect, seceding from the rest of the country. Al-Qaeda today in Iraq is also now in the process of spawning its own franchises throughout the Middle East. The fighting that we have seen in northern Lebanon, outside of the city of Tripoli, for the last 4 weeks between a Palestinian group, Fatah al-Islam, and the Lebanese army is a direct outcome of the al-Qaeda in Iraq franchise movement. Fatah al-Islam is headed by one of Mr. Zarqawi's disciples, and the majority of its troops are the product of the pipeline that brought people in and out of Iraq to support the insurgency. One of al-Qaeda's biggest goals after Iraq has been to create a franchise in the Maghreb, in Algeria, in order to create a second highway into Europe. Al-Qaeda, after September 11th, had a fundamental problem in attacking the West. Passports of 19 Saudis, Yemenis, Emiris, and Egyptians were not going to get you into America anymore. But Her Majesty's passport would get you in, and so will a French passport. Last year, on the anniversary of September 11th, al-Qaeda proudly announced the creation of an al-Qaeda in the Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, an al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb. On April 12th, this new group carried out simultaneous attacks throughout the city of Algiers, the first ever suicide operations in that country's history. And al-Qaeda has made abundantly clear that France is a target for this operation, and particularly for the large Algerian diaspora community in France. This diaspora offers the opportunity for a second highway to attack the West. These warnings from al-Qaeda about planned operations in France need to be taken very seriously, in my judgment. The ultimate franchise, however, that al-Qaeda would like to take over is in Palestine. And let me turn to the situation there to finish up. The Hamas movement in the West Bank and Gaza is one of the most credible Sunni jihadist movements in the world. It has carried out dozens of martyrdom suicide operations against Israeli targets, and it has an unblemished record of resistance to Israel. It's worth taking a moment to review the relationship between Hamas and al-Qaeda, because I think it is rich with insights into al-Qaeda's strategy and vulnerability. Hamas's founder and spiritual leader, Sheikh Yassin, before his death, said many positive things about al-Qaeda. For example, after his release from prison in 1997, he traveled throughout the Middle East, and when he was asked about Al-Qaeda, he said, "We support and sympathize with any movement which defends the rights of its people to enjoy self-governance and independence, but we are not prepared to seek an alliance with those movements." There is some evidence of operational contact between Al-Qaeda and Hamas, particularly in carrying out operations in Egypt in 2004 and 2005. But these contacts were fleeting and minor. Overall, Hamas has jealously guarded its independence from Al-Qaeda and from the global Islamic struggle. It argues its case is a national case, not a global case. Hamas knows all too well the sorry history of Palestinian movements which have aligned themselves with Arab patrons and become pawns in inter-Arab political warfare. Hamas has only developed relations with Syria and Iran in recent years out of the need for military assistance and particularly economic aid. In public, most Hamas officials have been careful to distance that organization from the violence of Al-Qaeda, especially the sectarian violence in Iraq. For its part, Al-Qaeda has reacted by becoming increasingly critical of Hamas, and especially its participation in the electoral process and its success, ironically, in winning the Palestinian legislative elections last year. Bin Laden and Zawahiri have been outspoken critics of the Hamas organization for pursuing the path of political involvement. Zawahiri, for example, last March, speaking about the national unity government formed between Palestinian factions in Mecca, claimed that Hamas had fallen into the swamp of surrender and that the leadership had sold out. He concluded by saying, "I am sorry to have to offer the Islamic nation my condolence for the demise of the Hamas leadership as it has fallen into the quagmire of surrender." Nobody, be he Palestinian or not, has the right to relinquish a grain of Palestinian soil, Zawahiri argued. Why this attack on a fellow Sunni Islamist movement? Because the very thought of movement towards an Arab-Israeli peace agreement, no matter how remote it may have seemed to us, was to Al-Qaeda blasphemy. And allies or potential allies that would go that route were the most dangerous allies of all. Hamas's response to these charges was also illuminating. In a formal statement, Hamas said, "We are a movement of jihad. We in the Hamas movement remain loyal to our position and to the dream of dying as martyrs. We assure Dr. Al-Zawahiri and all those who remain unwavering in their attachment to Palestine that today's Hamas is the same Hamas that you have known since its founding." In this dialogue between Al-Qaeda and Hamas, I believe we see a major vulnerability and worry of the Al-Qaeda leadership. It may seem remote and far away today to us, but they see the possibility of a settlement in Palestine as depriving them of one of the fundamental recruiting tools of their organization. We now are in a situation much different, even from March and April. Hamas in the last week has broken with the political process of reconciliation with Fatah. And in the last 48 hours, Hamas has created a Hamas mini-state on the Mediterranean, a Mogadishu on the Mediterranean in many ways. It is going to be extremely interesting to see the reaction of the Al-Qaeda leadership to these developments and how Hamas now determines to posture itself towards Al-Qaeda. Let me close with a few remarks. Understanding your enemy's strategy and thinking is critical to victory. We did that in World War II, and we did that in the Cold War. The West needs a grand strategy today for the greater Middle East that can win the war of ideas against Al-Qaeda. Their narrative has been remarkably successful in appealing to a small but potent minority of Muslims. Their narrative has won the war of ideas for far too many people in the Muslim world. Our counter-narrative has fallen on deaf ears. No one in the Middle East thinks that Iraq is a model of democracy they would like to emulate at home. No one in their right mind would see Iraq as a model of democracy. They do not believe our rhetoric that our goals are to promote democracy. Our side in the war of ideas is still poorly organized and often inarticulate. A good place to begin winning the war of ideas back, I believe, would be in the Arab-Israeli peace process. As hard as it is to imagine movement forward, we know one thing for sure. Neglecting that peace process, as we have for the last 5 years, is not the right option either. Clearly, Bin Laden, Mr. Zawahiri, were scared at even the prospect, however remote, of movement by Hamas. That must tell us something about what they judge as their own vulnerabilities. I have laid out in the article in Foreign Affairs I mentioned at the opening additional ideas for the grand strategy I believe it is essential this country adopts to defeat Al-Qaeda. And I'm not going to repeat them now, but I'd be happy to talk about them in questions and answers. What I want to close, though, with you is this. I believe only a concentration of effort and a concentration of resources to fight the core leadership of Al-Qaeda and defeat it in Pakistan and Afghanistan holds the option of victory in this war against this enemy. If we do not concentrate our resources and our attention there urgently, sooner or later, the Al-Qaeda organization will return to its strategy of raids, like what they call the Manhattan Raid. Let me finish there. I look forward to your comments and questions. Thank you.
Talk today, Mr. Riedel. Before we take to the question and answer session, before I make my way back, I'd like to pose a question to you about the communications devices that Al-Qaeda uses. You've mentioned all these different franchises that they have out there. How are they indeed communicating with one another? And before you answer that, if anyone has a question for Mr. Riedel, please join me in the back of the room.
That's how. That's it. They're brilliant at this. They are absolutely brilliant at this. The use of the internet, wireless technology, at creating websites that are up and gone in minutes, that transmit from one to another. To help me tell you what's going on in Iraq today, an attack on an American truck or tank will be filmed by an Al-Qaeda squad on the field, usually using a handheld wireless telephone, just like the ones you have. They will upload that on email, send it to a central Al-Qaeda facility. Within less than a half an hour, that film with appropriate background noise, and for us, English subtitles will be available on websites around the world. According to one expert I know, there's over 4,000 Islamic jihadist websites available today broadcasting that kind of imagery. when I said, we are not organized to fight the battle of ideas. That's the contrast I want to give you. They are extremely well organized.
Could you describe the participation of Iran in this picture? Thank you.
Iran and Al-Qaeda are fundamentally enemies. It's hard for me to understress the depth of Al-Qaeda's anti-Shia philosophy. One way to think about Al-Qaeda is that it is a struggle within the Wahhabi Muslim movement in Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden, in many ways, is arguing that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has lost faith with the principles of its religion. He doesn't argue that the religion is wrong or the principles are wrong. He just suggests that the Saudi royal family is not living up to those principles. Most especially, he argues, by supporting the Arab-Israeli peace process and the Oslo agreements. The Wahhabi brand of Islam is an extraordinarily anti-Shia movement. Its first major act on the stage of Middle East politics was to sack and pillage the Shia holy city of Karbala in Iraq in the 18th century. That anti-Shia stream is very strong in Al-Qaeda and in the Taliban. We've seen it most clearly manifested in Iraq, where Al-Qaeda has, since the occupation began, gone after and murdered Shia political leaders and blown up Shia shrines, as they just did again this week. I don't rule out the possibility of individuals from Al-Qaeda having tactical contact at some time in the past with Iranian intelligence services. In the murky world of the Middle East, odd bedfellows are what you should expect. But there is no evidence of a connection between Iran and Al-Qaeda in terms of Al-Qaeda's operational activity, in terms of funding it, financing it, sourcing it. We should see these two as enemies of each other. Now, they may end up, and in fact, I think they will end up being the two greatest beneficiaries of the war in Iraq. But that doesn't make them allies. In fact, it will make them enemies in the battle for Iraq after we go. Al-Qaeda in Iraq's biggest fear today is, in fact, what will happen when the Americans go. They believe the Safavids, their term for the Iranians and for their Iraqi Shia allies, will prevail. The Safavids are the Persian Empire that dominated the Gulf in the 16th and 17th century. One of Al-Qaeda in Iraq's fondest hopes, and they talk about it openly, is that the United States and Iran would go to war with each other, and their two biggest enemies would bloody themselves, and Al-Qaeda would benefit from it.
Greg Govan, retired military and State Department, and sometime worker for Charlie Allen, who I sure would want me to wish you a happy anniversary. My question is about the degree to which the success of the franchise has made it impossible or immaterial to attack Al-Qaeda by attacking a central leadership. Have we reached that point? And if so, what do we do about it?
That's a very good question. I can't help but take the opportunity, though. Charlie Allen, for those of you who don't know, is a legend in the American intelligence community. He is today the Assistant Secretary of Intelligence for the new Department of Homeland Security. He EOD'd at the Central Intelligence Agency as a young man in 1958, and he's still working harder than most of us worked at our 20s and I'll let you figure out what age he is today. It is a more difficult problem. The diffusion, the spread of Al-Qaeda, the creation of the Al-Qaeda movement, both in real space and in cyberspace, makes it harder and harder to go after. But the head is critically important in a number of ways. First, we know now from the British investigations of those attacks in London, and we know from what we have gathered in Iraq and other places, that these franchises do take their overall direction from the Al-Qaeda core. I don't mean that they say, attack this convoy at 0600 tomorrow morning. Of course not. But they do provide overall direction, and they provide legitimacy. That's one reason. But the second reason is this. It's 2,000 some days since September 11th. The fact that Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri are alive today, issuing statements, has created an awesome mystique throughout the Muslim world, that these guys are invulnerable, that the superpower can't get them. I'd say it's something like Robin Hood, but I think that's an insult to Robin Hood. The longer they are out there, the more that mystique will continue to exist. We have to smash that mystique. We have to bring justice to these people. If we don't, they will achieve a mythical, if not already, a mythical status. So you're absolutely right. Getting the core no longer will suffice to defeat the movement. In 2002, that might have worked. We lost that opportunity. But that is no excuse for not going after them today. To say that they're in a cave, or hiding, or not reviewing parades is a recipe for defeat, if not an acknowledgement of failure already.
I'm curious to know your ideas about Israel's response to a Hamas-controlled Gaza.
I'm sure glad I'm not the Israeli new Minister of Defense, Ehud Barak, a man I've known for more than 25 years and a very brave person. Be careful what you wish for. Someday they might actually give it to you. Now, having decided to come back from political oblivion, he faces an extremely difficult situation. But so does Hamas. The Gaza Strip is about the size of the District of Columbia, a little bit larger. Within it, there are 1.5 million people. All the electricity and all the water that they use come from Israel. Israel has the capacity, in theory, to create mass humanitarian disaster anytime it wants to in Gaza. It also undoubtedly has the military capability to go back into Gaza. And more Israelis believe that is what they should do, and that the withdrawal from Gaza, which was applauded by most Israelis only a couple of years ago, was a mistake. There is some hope today that we can now build an alternative. Hamas can have Gaza, and let's see how well they do. You're in charge, you build a better society. Fatah, the more moderate Palestinian movement, still controls most of the West Bank. A massive effort to help Fatah now, economically, but even more importantly, politically, by giving it control of the West Bank, by ending the expansion of Israeli settlements, by giving Fatah the legitimacy in the eyes of the Palestinians that it needs to have, might allow us the opportunity to build a contrast between a failing Hamas state in Gaza and a future for the Palestinians living in a liberated West Bank with prosperity. That will take from the United States and Israel remarkable sophistication of approach. We will have to really rise to the occasion now. In 2005, we had an opportunity. Mr. Arafat was dead. Mr. Abbas was new on the scene. The Iraq War had not turned into the quagmire yet that it is today. And Mr. Abbas pleaded for help from Israel and the United States. He didn't get it. And that's why we are where we are now. It wouldn't have been easy in 2005, and it's going to be a lot harder in 2007. But simply adopting a policy of isolating Hamas, turning off the electricity and the water, or invading Gaza and creating a bloodbath, I would argue, is a recipe for creating the situation Al-Qaeda is dreaming of. The franchise they most badly want would then be in their hands. So I think Mr. Barak has some tough choices to make, and I wouldn't envy his position one bit.
You, you've painted a very consistent picture on a macroscopic, from a macroscopic point of view, and you suggested that we need a grand strategy that would be consistent with that large-scale view. I have two questions. First one is, why do we lack that grand strategy? And my second question is, I think, if I understood you correctly, you emphasized an immediate focus on Afghanistan, but you did not mention Iraq, and I'd be curious as to why.
I believe that we have had difficulty coming to grips with the magnitude of the challenge that Al-Qaeda poses. I think the Bush administration, of which I was a part at the time in 2001, underestimated the Al-Qaeda threat before September 11th. I think the president in the months after September 11th got it and focused properly on what to do in Afghanistan. But then I think he lost attention and our eye drifted away from the ball that mattered, brought by the allure of Iraq. And I can't tell you why we did that. I think that's going to be historians' $64 million question about the Bush administration. But the consequence of that has been to allow them to recover and to revive. And I think it is in the failure to come to grips with the magnitude of the challenge that has led to the failure to have a grand strategy. We don't even seem sometimes to understand at the highest levels of our government what it is Al-Qaeda is about. We hear talk about they hate our liberty, they hate our freedom. They don't care about our liberty. Al-Qaeda couldn't care less whether we wanted to have a House of Burgesses in Virginia or a dictator in Virginia. What they're interested is in getting us out of the Middle East and out of the Muslim world and driving us out of there. And their strategy to do that is to bog us down in quagmires, just like the Soviet Union was bogged down in a quagmire in Afghanistan, which they believe in time will lead to our collapse. When we leave, they will overthrow what they call the apostate regimes, the Saudis, the Mubaraks, the Musharrafs, and then they will destroy Israel. And then they will have accomplished their objective. Until you begin to come to grips with that's what we're trying to fight, I don't think you can come up with a strategy to fight it. I do believe that the central battlefield of this war is in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I think the president has recognized somewhat belatedly that this February when he increased assistance to Pakistan and Afghanistan dramatically. But it's still too little. It's not enough. Afghanistan needs something on the order of the Marshall Plan in order to recover. And it needs it urgently. Otherwise, it is going to become ever more than it is today, a narcotic terrorist state. Iraq. I'd be the first person to tell you I don't have a good answer to the problem of Iraq. I don't think there are good answers. I think what we face today are a bunch of bad options. I think we need to recognize that. I think the Baker-Hamilton report had it exactly right. The situation in Iraq is dire and getting worse. Denial isn't going to make it any better. I also think that the war in Iraq is more of a trap than it is an opportunity. This is the kind of war al-Qaeda wants to fight, in which the Americans are seen as the foreign occupier, and they can paint this as a simple war between God-believing Sunni jihadists and an evil foreign empire. One of the things I think we should do, should have done from day one, is say we have no intention of permanent military bases in Iraq. We have no designs to stay there permanently. We have no designs to take over their oil industry. We are not going to force on them an oil law which is more to the benefit of foreign firms than it is to Iraqis. And we're not going to talk about creating a South Korea-like permanent military presence in Iraq. Every time we do that, we hand al-Qaeda a propaganda victory. So, my view is that we should begin the withdrawal from Iraq. It should be orderly, should be disciplined, should be phased, should be complete. We should do so in a manner that increases the legitimacy of the Iraqi government we put in power. We should work with them on a timeline, and the political direction to leave should come from Baghdad, not from Washington. That is the only way, I think, now we can help those Iraqis who we want to help establish their credibility and legitimacy. It's a long shot, but that's what we're back to, long shots.
There are three comments I'd like to make. One, the al-Qaeda did not exist in Iraq before our attack. Item two, the problems in northern Lebanon with Fatah al-Islam and the Lebanese government. These renegades, these people who hid behind the Palestinians at Nahr el-Bared are nothing but crooks, bank thieves. They are not Palestinians. They are from Yemen, they are from Sudan, they are from Jordan, they are from all over the Arab world who came and hid behind the Palestinians. And that's the last things that the Palestinians need. And the third item was in Gaza. The last year, the Israeli government and the Israeli troops cordoned Gaza and prevented any of their produce or any of their goods to be shipped out, thus causing more hatred for the Israelis by Hamas and the rest of the Palestinians. Just your comments on those three items, please.
I think we're in violent agreement on all three points. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq before September 11th. There is not a shred of evidence of a connection between the Saddam Hussein government and the attacks of September 11th. The most infamous meeting that never took place in history, that between an Iraqi intelligence officer and Mohammed Atta, has been thoroughly discredited, and the Czech government has said they made a mistake. It never happened. But as I said, al-Qaeda had a plan for what to do when the Americans went in. Second, you're absolutely right about Fatah al-Islam, but that's not unusual. Mr. Zarqawi was a thug, a petty criminal, a violent abuser of people. The Al-Qaeda movement attracts these kinds of people. It's not a group of nice people. These are violent, vicious terrorists. But they can be very, very effective. They certainly do not represent the Palestinian people. And thirdly, I would agree with you as well. In hindsight, the policy of encouraging elections and then refusing to deal with the result of elections is a mistake. It was hypocritical, and it was a mistake. And we are suffering from the ramifications of that today. And that is not because I believe Hamas is a bunch of good guys. There are a lot of thugs and criminals in that organization as well. But if you hold an election, and you've got someone who wins, you've got to deal with them in a different way. And I think we made a mistake then, and we're paying the consequences of it now. How we get out of that mistake is going to be very, very hard to do.
Going along with how hard this is to do, I wanted to go back to your mention of the narrative and the missing narrative and how important that will be in a positive sense to give us something to be working towards. And I've been waiting and hoping that would come out, but I haven't quite gotten it. And if you could speak to that more, I'd appreciate it.
I think this is a very crucial element. Let me start here. I've given you a lot of bad news. I know that. It comes with being a professional intelligence officer. We tend to dwell in bad news. But let me conclude. This isn't the last question, but we're getting to the end. Let me conclude with a piece of, I think, good news in the long run. The vast majority of Muslims in this world are not interested in creating a Taliban-style caliphate to run their world. They're not interested in having their women wearing burqas and not being able to watch TV except to watch martyrdom videos or to only using the internet to get messages about jihad. The vast majority of Muslims are our ally in this war. They are the target for a different narrative, a narrative that rejects the notion of a clash of civilizations, which seeks to work with and find allies in the Muslim world, and which is backed by concrete actions. In the 1990s, under President Bush, 41, and President Clinton, it was much easier for an American diplomat to speak to a Muslim audience and say, we are working together. Because you had concrete examples. We were working to help the Muslim communities of Bosnia and Kosovo, and we were working for peace in the Middle East. When Gaza was liberated in 1993, and Hebron and Nablus in 1995 and 1996, through the Oslo process, which had its mistakes, but which did bring about a measure of Palestinian self-rule, we had a powerful argument that we were the force that was going to bring peace and justice to this conflict. Our narrative has to be backed by actions. Our president needs to be involved directly in actions which can demonstrate that we are serious about advancing peace, not just in Palestine, but in the Balkans, in Kashmir, and in other places. If we cede the battlefield, then we have no counter-narrative, and their narrative dominates. And unfortunately, that's what we've been doing. I've spent a lot of time in several administrations working on public diplomacy and press guidance. I can tell you one thing. The best spinmeisters in the world, no matter how good they are, can only spin so far. They got to have some real facts and some actions to go with it. And that's why we're having trouble today.
This will be the last question for today.
It may be too big a question. The Middle East is vast. There are countries that are never mentioned in the struggle. On the north, you have Syria and Jordan. In the south, you have Saudi Arabia and Egypt, which plays a very little part in any of the commentary. And along the Mediterranean, you have Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya. Is there any chance that this narrative would lead to a kind of concert amongst most, some, or all of those that would help us out? Or has the well so been so poisoned by the last 6 years that there's really no hope of drawing people out of concern only for their own population and survival?
I think there is hope. I believe we can win this war. As I said, I think the numbers are on our side if we can only mobilize them correctly. I also believe it doesn't need to be, it's a fashionable term of the former SINC for CENTCOM, General Abizaid. He used to like to call it the long war. As soon as he left, I understand CENTCOM dropped that phrase from their terminology, I think correctly. It doesn't need to be a long war. The right actions done with skill and with resources can change it. I believe that the countries that you mentioned and leaders of those countries, like King Mohammed in Morocco, King Abdullah in Jordan, the King of Bahrain and others, are dying for the opportunity to see a concert of moderate Muslims who could stand together, work with the United States, work with Israel to try to change the narrative. And I think we can still do that. It is a measure of the trouble we are in, though, that this year, this White House has invited President Mubarak, has invited King Abdullah of Jordan, and has invited King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia to visit for their normal annual visits. None of them are coming. That's extraordinary. Our three most important allies in the Arab world are saying they won't come because they don't want to be in the same picture. They're not coming in 2007. They're not coming in 2008, I can tell you that. So 2009 becomes, I think, the year that we need to reverse this struggle and begin building the grand strategy and the grand coalition we need to win it. Thank you.